Welcome to an all-new summer edition of the 3-Bid League podcast. As always, I'm Tyler, joined by my co-host, Matt. And we got a fun three-part episode for you here. We're going to kick things off with another fantastic mailbag. Thank you to everyone who sent in questions to us. As always, we appreciated them, and we continue to really get some great ones. Later on in the episode, though, we're going to be joined by Lil Bonna X to talk about St. Bonaventure's offseason and the rising expectations around that team, one of probably the more controversial teams in terms of everyone's projections at this point in the offseason. And then he'll stick around. We'll close out this episode with a completely non-basketball segment talking about everyone's favorite summer Netflix show. But that'll come later in the episode. Matt, you got the mailbag with you. How should we start things off?
Yeah, let's talk some basketball, because right now our favorite baseball teams are fighting each other to stay out of last place. So it'll be fun to talk about a different sport for a change. And like you said, thanks to everybody for giving us some fun topics to talk about here in the middle of the summer. I think we should start with Grant, who gave us a couple of excellent questions, a couple that I haven't really thought about. And I think we should start... not really A-10 specific, but I'm just curious your thoughts, because I don't know in 5 or 6 years if we've ever gone there. He wanted us to talk about what two rules would you add or change to make college basketball better? Because I think that's one of the perfect off-season topics that's always getting brought up.
We did not intentionally order the questions here. You don't even know what my answer is, but I'm going to hit on kind of the news of the week here. So I have one big overarching rule change and one minutia rule change. The overarching one is that football conferences should just be separate from all other college sports. And it's not going to impact the A-10 too much, since none of these are football schools, but it's tearing away a lot of the best parts of the college basketball world. And I say this as someone who grew up rooting for Pitt, who would want nothing more in the college basketball world than to see them play in the Big East again. And there's just no reason for this one big money sport where really only 40 to 50 schools matter, even in the tiniest way, to influence everything. And when you really start to think about, well, what could the conferences look like if they actually were dictated by geography and still size and still pedigree, but about 12 teams each, where you could have at the top a Big East that resembles kind of the old model, with a lot of those Catholic basketball schools plus Pitt, Syracuse, West Virginia. You could have a West Coast conference that took all of the best Pac-12 teams and threw in Gonzaga, St. Mary's, and San Diego State. And even for this conference specifically, I think the A-10 would kind of look the same largely, except St. Louis wouldn't be here, and Davidson would probably just be back in the SoCon if they ever did truly leave. But you could also end up with potentially a great Midwestern conference where, depending on how things broke, you could have Dayton, Xavier, Cincinnati, Louisville, Butler, Loyola, Marquette, DePaul, St. Louis, Wichita State, Creighton, maybe even Notre Dame all together in a conference. And for all the Dayton and St. Louis fans who want to clamor for the faraway dream of the Big East, that's a pretty good substitute.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think we've talked plenty on here just lamenting about how teams don't play their historical rivals anymore. And conference realignment's a big reason for that. With, I'd say, about half the A-10 schools not even playing football, I think you're right that this isn't the type of thing that's going to dramatically change the way we see college basketball. But yeah, there's going to be a lot of changes just to college athletics in general. And I think something else that I'm really interested to see how it'll shake out is most other sports, or really all of them, don't have the same budgets as football. And all the travel is really just both a strain financially and physically on the athletes. getting to places. So we'll see. But yeah, I mean, it just in general, I'm not sure what it's going to mean for the A10 or mid majors in general yet. So I guess getting into the rule changes, though. And I started out with a couple college basketball, or I should even say men's college basketball specific things where I've heard people complain about, and I kind of like them. Two halves I want to keep. I know
Yeah, I'm
men's
fine with
college
that.
basketball, that's the only one. Wait, did you say you'd want to change that?
No, I said I'm fine with it, although I would support four quarters just for less media timeouts,
I
which
mean,
would
that
be
would
my
be
third rule
fine.
change. Like, we just don't need to have this many commercials.
But I
This
like
could
the
be
one
the
and
quickest,
one.
most compact sport ever, and they just choose to not let it be that way.
But I like the one and one. I don't want
Oh, I do
fouls to
too.
reset. I know people complain about that. I like the possession arrow. I think it's complete crap where if a point guard ties up a center, they just have no chance. I've never liked that in the NBA. No advancing the ball. I want to keep it that way. I know that's a controversial one. So a lot of things very specific to men's college basketball, though, that you don't see at pretty much all other levels. But a few ideas I did have, and I thought back to the classic St. Bonaventure Davidson triple overtime game. And back in 2018, I believe, where both Peyton Aldridge and Jalen Adams fouled out. I wish you could get an extra foul if the game went to overtime, because five, when the game gets, 45, 50 minutes, that's not a whole lot to give. And I think something like that, where you extend the game and let players remain in the game longer, would be a benefit to everybody.
It's like tennis where you get an extra challenge if you go to a tiebreaker. I've thought that that's a simple addition for, and I didn't even think about it when I was trying to figure out this answer because it's not even a men's college basketball specific thing. Like that should just be a universal basketball rule from every level on down. I'll take it a step further. This actually probably should have been my number two, but I have spoken to you many times about the concept of foul trading,
Yeah, I hate this. I'm not a fan.
where coaches during these timeouts, and this is essentially just a defense against refs who just overcall the game, where when we end up in these situations where, oh, all of a sudden both team centers have three fouls early in the second half, let's just clear the slate. And it really wouldn't happen as often as you would probably think initially, because if Deron Holmes is in foul trouble, like Dayton's gonna have to clear the fouls for four of their opposing team's players to make that happen. It's basically got to be star on star or like two equivalent level role players guarding each other to make that happen. But it just helps the games to be better in the event that you have an overzealous ref.
I think for a fan perspective, it would be great. I just don't see a time where coaches would ever agree on it. And I think like whoever is the deeper bench is going to want to keep the other team's star out of the game. So we'll see. But I don't think the coaches would ever come to a compromise. And that's a pace of play thing too, like you're talking about. I mean, do we need to use the media timeouts for the coaches to go discuss
You
that
do
type
it
of strategy?
like sub rules when you're playing NBA 2K as a kid. Like you gotta call a timeout to be able to do this.
Yeah, that's fair. My one other idea, and I'm not sure how you feel about this. You watch a lot more professional basketball than me, but just with how important floor spacing is now, I wonder how expanding the key to where it is at the NBA, if college basketball players are even skilled enough to make that aesthetically pleasing. But we have expanded the 3-point line a couple times in the last 15 years, so it almost feels like that one's coming to me.
Oh, did you say expanding the key? In my mind, I processed it as moving back to 3-point line.
Oh, no, I think that's far enough. I mean, it's
Yeah, that would be
already.
terrible
No,
because I
that's.
think
No,
teams
keep
would still
that.
shoot the same amount and it would just be worse. Yeah, given that college basketball doesn't have defensive 3 seconds like the NBA does, it wouldn't have as much impact. But I think it probably does help for a team like Dayton, actually, who's going to have one big rim running center with a bunch of shooters around him this season, that it kind of gives them reasons to keep Daron Holmes out of the paint, to keep him moving around, to make him more of a weapon off the dribble than throwing him post up. So yeah, it changes the strategy a little bit, but I'm not sure how much of a difference it would make.
Yeah, probably not. But do you have any other rule changes or ready to move on to anything else?
Yeah, my second one, I'm so glad that you went with that, because my next one really kind of ties in with something similar. And you're going to hate this.
Oh, boy.
It's time to get rid of the charge. Like, the reason that that rule was developed was for late 20th century, early 2000s NBA, where you had people like Shaq, who, without any kind of foul rules, would just treat people like they were like just children coming at him in a wrestling match. But as the game changes, like, the charge as it's written, and I'm not talking about like when you run into a guy with your forearm, I don't consider that a charge, that's a different play entirely. But the charge is meant to defend against the style of basketball that just really is not there anymore. You don't have to worry about big brooding centers getting switched onto somebody's shooting guard and just plowing them over, because teams just don't have big brooding centers that play that way anymore. And I think about a team like Dayton this year, where Daron Holmes is not going to be trying to post up small guys that often. What he is going to be trying to do is drive with the ball and catch it out of the pick and roll and try to attack the rim. Well, the charge rule then helps defenses that are caught in a switch, that if your point guard all of a sudden is guarding the rim and Daron Holmes is barreling down on him, all he's got to do is set his feet when he's maybe not even looking at him and just get hit. That's not defense. That's just trash ball. You would never see someone do that in a pickup game. And for all the dirty crap that I've witnessed in pickup over the years, no one has ever tried to take a charge in over a decade. I've never seen it one single time. No one does this in any other form of basketball. And it just really does nothing for the game. Like, you just end up with guys flying into the lane, trying to throw passes and getting charges because some little dude just decided to stand there.
Well, as a little dude who has taken one or two charges in my day, I just think it's important not to completely eliminate the offensive foul. And like you mentioned, driving into someone with your forearm, if you're completely out of control, I'm okay with that getting called as an offensive foul. But there's definitely times, like I would say somebody going up for a layup when they're already in the air and a defender slides underneath, that should never get called. And I don't think we should completely eliminate the charge, because there's times where the offensive player is just completely reckless. And I think that should be called. But there's definitely too many in college basketball. And I want to say it's gotten better from a couple years ago, but there's still work to be done.
But like, I kind of just don't care about the recklessness thing. Like, if somebody's just out of control, spinning and swerving to the rim, then you can probably just challenge them there and alter their shot. Like, I don't think you need to take a hit there. And I honestly, I think the biggest thing, I'm amazed that we've gone this long with this in basketball and with the Kyle Lowry influence of, like you said, just kind of sliding under players as they're already turning to go up in the air, that thank God we've never had a truly major injury on a play like that. In now, I'm sure it probably happened to somebody in a high school game and somewhere in this country, but it's never happened on a high profile big stage moment.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, there are always rule changes. It feels like we've had a lot in the last couple of years. The one, since it's a hot topic, I also just want to add, I don't want the Elam ending, not in real games. I know this is the time of year people enjoy it. It's fun in TBT, but I still like having a clock at the end, having games go to overtime. I'm not ready for that one just yet.
It is perfect for summer basketball.
Exactly. Something to get, if I'm watching basketball in July, something needs to get me interested. And that's one of those things. But I don't need it. College basketball is exciting enough at the end of games. Most of the time, there's times where it would be beneficial with a different ending.
Yeah,
But
sorry to fellow A10 alum Matt Elam.
yeah,
It's
that
not
is
coming.
true. He is one of us. All right. So Grant gave us a couple other really good questions, though, I think that are good to start with, because kind of just on the state of college basketball in general. And he asked, are mid-majors doomed with expanding Power Five conference play and the net rankings, making scheduling mid-majors not as worthwhile? And my initial reaction is mid-majors can't really be doomed because the Mountain West is coming off back-to-back four bid seasons and they just sent a team to the national title game. Now, the A-10 clearly hasn't lived up to that standard, not even close in the last 5 years, but mid-majors have still had some success, so I'm not ready to say that all of those conferences together have no chance anymore.
My short answer is no. My long answer is short of another drastic change to the composition of the selection committee, like somehow finding a way to eliminate two of the mid-major representatives and just grabbing like two more SEC university presidents, I don't think it can be any worse than it already is right now. And right now is a universe where we're still getting 3 to 5 mid-major at-large teams every year. And it seemed worse because the wealth hasn't really been spread the last few years. It's been primarily the Mountain West and St. Mary's who've taken up those spots. Now, I think the low majors are doomed. The fact that College of Charleston had to get the auto bid to make it last year means that we're never going to see a situation again like happened just 4 years ago when Furman got a 7 seed after dominating the SoCon. Like, I don't think that Furman team was really that much better than what College of Charleston did last year. And yet they wouldn't have even gotten an at-large bid. So, unless you're from a traditional multi-bid conference with that reputation, A10, Mountain West, West Coast, I guess the American, even though they've realigned like 9 times since then. Maybe the Missouri Valley. We saw Drake sneak in a few years ago, but I think the mid-majors are still okay. They just got to play better like the Mountain West did last year.
So one comment on that though, well, one, I think you meant Wofford, who went to the tournament that year as a
Yeah, I
seven
did.
seed. But I actually think there is still a chance, and it's just different how resumes come together than they did 15, 20 years ago. Like what I think of is GW back in 2006 going like 30-2 and getting a 9 seed versus Wofford a couple years ago, probably didn't have quite as good of a schedule playing in the SoCon. But the reason they were seeded so high is they were 18th in KenPom. And you look at Charleston last year, they were, I think, a fringe top 100 team by the metrics. So I think it's all just driven by efficiency now. And if you are a low major, I still think you can get a single digit seed if you blow enough teams out and maybe pick up one or two big wins early in the season. It's just that you don't see it often because the margin is so small. And if you lose one bad game to the 320th ranked team on the road, then your dream might be over. So there's just not a whole lot of room. But I do think it's still possible. Although, like we see with the Big Ten every year, they just stack Q1 games by beating up on each other, and then none of them make any noise in the postseason.
Yeah, and the good thing is we've still at least seen the committee resist the idea of like a 6-12 team. Like I think 7-11 is basically the lowest that they're willing to go if you played well in the non-con and then kind of fell apart later on. But really all I'd say for fans of mid-major teams is if you're looking for hope, look at what Utah State did last year. And that's kind of the archetype of a bunch of different A10 teams that we've seen get at large bids the last few years. One bad loss in the non-con, rip through a tough conference schedule, pick up a bunch of Q2 wins, and make a little bit of a run in the conference tournament, and they walked in as a 10 seed.
Yeah. All right. One more question, just on college basketball in general, and it's about the portal era. So How do we go about evaluating teams with immediate transfers now? And how important is cohesion versus just getting the best transfers and the most talented players? So for you, what do you think has changed with that since we started this podcast?
The weirdest thing is that the one piece of that question that shouldn't have changed is the one thing that definitely has. Like, we've see it over and over again. Look at Dayton last year. Look at St. Louis last year. Having cohesion kind of doesn't mean anything anymore. How many teams in the last 5 years, not only in this conference, look at like preseason number one, North Carolina last year. Look at the UCLA team of 2 seasons ago after they made the Final Four. Everyone thought they were a locked top five team. They still made the tournament, and I think they won a game, but they didn't hit anywhere near their expectation. Just bringing back everybody means nothing at this point. And it seems like teams, for whatever reason, struggle to grow together. Now, there's a limit to being able to take a brand new team like Duquesne did last year. And I think the fact that they had no cohesion hurt them in some of those bad non-conference games they played. The ideal is to be what VCU was last season. Bring back a strong core and find the perfect pieces around it. Find Brandon Johns and David Shriver. Like, complement what you have.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Not exactly what I thought of, although it's similar. I just feel like the idea of experience has gotten overrated in college basketball circles. And the Dayton and St. Louis teams you mentioned are great examples, or St. Bonaventure 2 years ago, where just having older players, fourth or fifth year seniors, doesn't always translate to success. And I think even, having the immediate transfers and easily being able to bring in a junior or senior, it looks great on paper, but I think part of it, there's only 200 minutes to go around each game. And when you get a whole bunch of older players on the same team, they're all going to want to play. I mean, maybe they sat more as underclassmen, but as they get to the end of their careers, I think that's a tough balance. And we saw it a little bit, I think, with St. Louis last year, having six or seven seniors, shuffling them all through the rotation. I'm interested how Duquesne works through that this year, bringing in some grad transfers. So I just think the important thing that we've learned, though, the last 2 years, older doesn't always mean better. And we saw Dayton also 2 years ago with the youngest team in the country. They didn't quite make the tournament, but they were still pretty successful in the A-10.
Yeah, I mean, cohesion and age has really only mattered for 4 days in March for Richmond, that same
Yeah.
season. And that's kind of been true for the entirety of the era of this podcast.
Yes, it has. All right. Well, we'll get into a few more A10 specific questions now. We have a couple good ones from Bonnet Nation, and he wanted us to pick the biggest letdown to start this season and who's going to be the biggest letdown at the end of the season. So I'll start out with the end of the season. The first name that came to mind, just right now, we're starting to see Dayton get a lot of first place buzz. They're getting the auto bid right now in ESPN's bracket. I just feel like Dayton's an easy pick for this because it's almost feeling like anything less than first place will feel like a disappointment. And I'm not sure that's a fair label because it is pretty wide open. And this is a team who lost some very talented players last season.
I tried to classify disappointment like almost from the standpoint of a team's fans. Do we really think that if Dayton does their normal, like, oh, finish third and NIT-ish team, like Dayton fans will be frustrated, but are they really going to feel like a lost opportunity was there? Like, I don't think Sully's going to be having a conversation with somebody on Talking Out Loud in March about, well, man, I can't believe how much of a disappointment this team was. Like, I think Dayton fans don't think they're the best team in this conference.
I think it well, I mean, the Dayton fan base also, you've got two very different types of people who look at the team. So I think it depends which part of the fan base you're talking about there. But still, I would say at this point, I mean, we don't know. It's a couple months away, but I'd say they are the most likely team to get picked first. And
I think they will be.
so, I mean, they just have, I'd say, the most to lose, I guess, in that regard. But other than that, I mean, the other team really starting to get hyped up a lot, St. Joe's, who we've seen picked in the double bye race by a lot of people. And just given that they haven't reached that ceiling yet under Billy Lang, it's just starting to feel like if they have another year similar to the last two, that could be a very big disappointment for a fan base that is definitely hungry for some success.
They're my pick, and until I see them play three straight really encouraging defensive games in a row in the non-con, I'm just gonna approach them with a level of pessimism and really kind of keep my guard up. They still haven't really accomplished much, but I almost wonder what classifies as a disappointment for St. Joe's, because like they could finish middle of the pack and it's still a huge step up, but I think the expectations have climbed to a point that was it probably anything outside of the top four would be considered underperforming this year?
I'd say so. I mean, if they go 9-9 and finish eighth place, yeah, that would be their best season in a while. But I don't see how you come away happy with that when you have preseason a top three player in the conference with Eric Reynolds, plus a talented freshman class. But what about to start the season? I think it's a little bit of a different answer. I ended up going, I think Fordham and VCU, two teams that had a lot of success last year, and both turning over quite a bit of the roster. In the case of VCU, pretty much everybody, including the coach. I could just see both of them getting off to slower starts as they figure out the rotation. In Fordham's case, figure out who's going to replace Quisenberry and Khalid Moore. But not pessimistic overall. I feel like they're both going to figure it out by conference play. They just seem like teams that had a lot of success that have a little bit more rebuilding to do.
Yeah, so I went with St. Bonaventure here. The expectations are starting to build. I think a lot of people put them squarely in the double bye race right now. But they're going to have to rejigger their rotation, as I've talked about previously. Someone from last year's starting five is probably going to fall out of the rotation by the end of the year. And it's going to be kind of a slow piecing together to figure out that right lineup. We saw it last year. They didn't really start to click until Moses Flowers came in for Barry Evans. That wasn't until early February. And Mark Schmidt, he is a great coach at pushing the right buttons by February and having his team at their best at the end of the season. But it's not hard to find a lot of examples of things not going right for the Bonnies with the wrong rotation early in the season. Look at when Justin Winston was still starting over Jalen Attaway on the team that eventually made the NCAA tournament. Look at them losing that terrible Niagara game opening night at home on a team that made the NCAA tournament. Look at last year, where it seems like they really didn't have a good handle on the rotation. Chad Venning played like 8 minutes on opening night. Now, I don't think you get Charles Pride without telling him he's going to start from day one. But I think it's going to be him and four starters from last year. And the odds that that's the right lineup is just kind of low. I think they're going to have to kind of tinker as things go along. And you look at this schedule, home Longwood, home Canisius, they go to the Legends Classic, come back home Bucknell, home Miami of Ohio. God, it feels like there's going to be a terrible epitome of brutality in that. And then start off December, three straight rivalry games. They're at Buffalo, at Niagara, home Siena. Do you think there is any chance that they get through that stretch unscathed versus the inevitable Twitter conversation of, well, why are these guys still playing their rivalry games if they're going to lose one of them every year?
No, I don't really, but I also think if there's one team ever not to panic about after a bad loss in the non-conference at St. Bonaventure, I think Mark Schmidt and his team have shown a better ability than anybody to recover from a bad start to the season. So I do think that is a good pick. That's another team that's got a lot to figure out, but we've seen it happen before and come together in the second half of the season for the Bonnies. But another good question from Bonna Nation. I think we discussed a little bit. Should we be worried about the direction of the league and what can we do to improve this season, if anything? I think this is a short answer. They just need to win in the non-conference. And I feel like we talk about that every time around this time of the year. And it hasn't really happened for a while.
That's exactly my answer. And when we hopefully have him on closer to the season, I'm sure that the great Dr. John Giannini is going to tell us the same thing. You just got to win more quality non-con games. Like it's really just that simple.
Yeah, I don't really think there's that much else to add. I mean, yeah, it's important to have good schedules too, and we have a little bit more on that later, but you just got to win those games early in the season. And then the last question from Bonna Nation, was it smart for St. Joe's to keep their coach Billy Lang, or will it come back to bite them? And that was a little bit of a talking point earlier in the offseason when St. Joe's gave Lang a multi-year extension. Although I think that's mostly just he was in his contract year, giving him a little bit more security. I think we'll have the answer after this season. I mean, if St. Joe's reaches that top four potential, if Reynolds is the player of the year and they make some noise in the A-10 tournament, then you could definitely say that was a smart decision. But if he can't get it done with this roster, then I think that raises a lot of big questions on when will St. Joe's get back to the top.
I'm not going to call it smart because, quite frankly, I think when you sit down, it was obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll always kind of err closer on the side of keeping your coach, giving them time to build. And this is still the same administration that hired Lang years ago. But you look at what he did at Navy. He never had that like great flash in the pan year. I don't even think he made a tournament there. But what he did was just consistently put together solid teams at a place where it's really tough to win. And it was a slow, slow, slow process there. And so if you're going to hire Billy Lang and expect results immediately, then that would have been a bad hire. You hire him to put together the roster that you have right now. Because by the way, this is also a guy who publicly said last year, not when he got hired, but last year, that he doesn't really like to use the transfer portal. He wants to bring in freshmen and mold them. And so the whole point is to get the talent that they have this season. And when you looked at that roster on paper in March, what it was going to be, you had to just bring them back and you see what happens. Could it come back to bite them? Oh, absolutely. If this team underperforms, they're going to wish that they had just kind of cut bait and started the next iteration this year. But this was the move that had to be made because you had to keep this roster together. And now we just wait and see what Billy Lang does with what, quite frankly, is a top four talent team in this conference.
Yeah, I mean, even though the last 2 years even haven't been great, I still don't think you let him go with his most talented team on paper coming in next season. And I mean, at this point, you might as well give him at least one more year to prove himself. I also just don't think you can fire a legend and then fire his successor after only 4 years. It seems like if you're making that move, you need some conviction to stand by it.
Yeah, and it definitely doesn't hurt that they played well the last 3 weeks.
They did. They ended the season on a good note.
Yeah, this is a tougher conversation if they had just continued to play like crap through March and the optimism wasn't quite there from the fans about the great finish.
Yeah. All right, moving on to the next question from George Templeton of the Rams Rewind podcast. Wanted us to talk a little bit about the A-10's non-conference scheduling. He said it's potentially a lot better than last year. So looking at this, I mostly just paid attention to a couple of the teams that are perceived as favorites. I don't know if overall I'd say it's that much stronger than last year, and I'm not sure it really matters. I think it kind of just goes back to what we said. Yeah, they just need to win. I mean, it's not a whole lot different. A couple notes I did have, though. St. Joe's, while we're on the subject of them, going at Kentucky, they play Villanova in their Big Five series, and then they play Charleston. So good to see the Hawks challenging themselves, knowing that they have a talented team coming in. The other one I'm interested for your thoughts on, though, Duquesne, coming off a year where they pretty much played all home games in the non-con. Now they're going at Nebraska and Marshall. They're also playing Charleston on a neutral court. So seems like a
In
little
Santa
bit,
Clara.
yeah. So it seems like a little bit of a better schedule for the Dukes, maybe playing up to what could be a better team than last year.
Yeah, and quick shout out to George. Everyone go listen to Rams Rewind. He's done a ton of really good stuff over the offseason, breaking down the players on VCU's roster. And he actually just did an episode on VCU's non-conference schedule with Rocco Miller. And Rocco in there slipped in that Duquesne is trying to find another quality West Coast team to play them when they're out in Vegas to play Santa Clara. So it'd be another good team again. I'd like to see them find one more hard game, especially if they can get something on the road that you feel really confident will be a Q1 game if you really do have tournament aspirations. But I'm not going to complain about this at all because every Duquesne non-conference schedule in the 21st century has just been a pile of crap. They've played nobody for like 20 years, other than when Pitt, West Virginia, and Penn State would still just play them as a regional rivalry. Like those four games that we went through already are might be the toughest stretch that they've ever had in our lifetimes. It's certainly the toughest they've had since the Everhart years. The Ferry schedules were bad. Like everybody saw what their non-con was the last few years under Dan Brott, where they played some decent mid-majors, but they played them all at home. And I firmly believe if you think you can make a run, whether it's to the tournament or to the NIT or to the top four, you need to challenge yourself a half a dozen times in the non-con. And these games are going to do that. And one quick side note on that, nobody panic when they lose to Marshall and Huntington. Like, it's just going to happen. They play so bad against that team every time that they get them. And if Duquesne actually goes down to Marshall and beats Dan D'Antoni and company, then they probably will make the tournament.
All right, that's a bold claim, but it is exciting to see the Dukes go away from home, play a couple more tougher teams. The one I was curious about, though, for VCU, you want to talk about a team not really going on the road. They don't have a true away game in the non-conference, and really, other than bye games, their schedule was pretty much just the ESPN Events Invitational, which is always a good field. But then they've got Memphis and Temple at home. Otherwise,
Temple might suck.
Temple also not very good, even though they beat VCU last year, but they lost a lot of guys too. So what gives me a little bit of hope is just that Ryan Odom and Utah State managed to make the tournament and have a really great season despite the lack of marquee wins and just winning those second tier of games consistently. So maybe that's his plan for this year too. But I mean, outside of they're probably going to get one or two Q1 games in Orlando, but otherwise, I mean, they're kind of just banking on Memphis being really good again.
They did a really great job of finding quality bye games. They're playing a lot of teams that are going to end up in the top 200 that you just kind of hope that those end up being really solid tier three games, that you don't really have any Q4 wins piling up on your resume. But with this schedule, if they have tournament hopes, they better hope that they win 11 games. Because, like you said, there really is only four good opportunities. And it's hard to fault them without being in the room because it's just tough for a quality program with a reputation like VCU to find a good team that's willing to play them at all. But I really hope that they called basically every team in the top 50 and asked them for a game. And if someone responded with, yeah, we'll give you a game, but you have to come to our place, then they should have taken it. I don't like teams not playing road games in the non-con. Like, you can't roll in January into UD Arena or into Shea Fitz or into the Riley Center, where those environments are going to be ruckus and tough, and expect to win all of those games when you don't challenge yourself early on. Duquesne was a victim of that last year. They were bad on the road to start conference play. It took them a while to get going. And I'll pivot here real quick to the one thing, because I've only dug into about half the non-con schedules by now. There's one that does really bug me, and that's GW's. Their December slate is just trash. Like, every team that it's very possible that every team they play will be outside the top 300. And if they lose any one of those games, that is a resume murderer. And by the way, I don't think GW is going to make the NCAA tournament, but like, you still need to put together a decent resume so that beating you helps other teams, or losing to you doesn't hurt them so bad. And it's one of the worst five-game stretches of non-con scheduling I have ever seen. They play a D2 school in the middle of December. And it just kind of reminds me of Fordham last year. They played that worst in the country non-conference schedule. And you know what happened? They stunk the first 2 weeks of conference play. Like, through four games, you could have made a case that they were going to be the worst team in the A-10. And obviously they weren't. But their first conference game, Davidson just absolutely killed them. And I think that might happen with GW this year. And I hate it from our perspective, because basically our only chances to evaluate this new GW roster are going to come in against South Carolina, and I think it's Hofstra that they play, and then in their tournament. And then in December, they're just going to pummel everybody. We're not going to be able to glean anything from it. And then they'll probably sleepwalk into the start of conference play, and their first game or two will probably be pretty ugly.
Yeah, well, congrats to Fordham at least, though, because it looks like they won't have the worst schedule anymore. And it's still not great. At least the Rams get St. John's on the road to renew that rivalry, which will be exciting. And they get North Texas at the Barclays Center. So still not a very good schedule for Fordham, but
It's
that
still
was
better
one
than
other
last
note.
year. They
Yeah,
play
I'm glad that
Tulane
they're
again.
scheduling up a
Oh.
little bit more, which is good. But yeah, otherwise, I mean, I think a lot of teams are the same. Dayton has a good schedule. They do have two true road games, which hasn't always been common for them, going at Northwestern and SMU. So we will see. Is this going to be the year that Anthony Grant wins a non-conference road game? Because I think he's 0-6.
To me, this, I didn't bring it up because it doesn't really answer George's question, but Dayton has the most fascinating non-conference schedule to me, because they play at Northwestern and then they immediately go down to Charleston, where they're almost certainly going to get three quality games there. Like, they're the sixth ranked team in that tournament by Torvik projection rank, playing LSU opening day. We just found that out. If they win, they'll probably get St. John's. And then a quality team in either the championship or the third place game. I almost feel like they have to go 3-1. They definitely cannot go 1-3, because they don't have opportunities to fight their way back from that. They get UNLV at home and they go to SMU, and that's it. And
They get Cincinnati still.
oh, yeah, I forgot about that one. But God, are any of those teams going to be top 50 this year? Like, are any of those going to be a resume turning potential victory? Probably not. And the reason that it's so interesting is because the big hallmark of Anthony Grant teams is they don't get it together the first 2 weeks of the year. They have consistently, whether it was really getting rolling in Maui with the Obie team after some could have been better bye games that they at least won, or 2 years ago, where they dropped the three straight bye games at home and then go beat Kansas. Like, this team never plays well the first 2 weeks of the year. In this season, if they don't play well the first 2 weeks of the year, they are not getting an at-large bid. And we can just end that discussion right then and there. So they're going to have to change a lot of stuff. Like you said, they still haven't won a road non-conference game. Something's going to have to give, or they're going to be staring at NIT or worse, save for getting an auto bid.
Well, that's a good transition talking about auto bids because, or and at large bids, because Trent asked us, what's the state of the A10? Is it one bid, seven bids? Will the Dukes finally make the tournament? Kind of a lot of questions packaged into one, but I mean, I think we can start there. What would you put the odds of the A10 getting an at large bid or this year? Because it clearly didn't happen last year, and by all accounts, most people seem to be pretty pessimistic on the league as a whole. And maybe that's just a huge overcorrection to all the buzz the conference had last year. But it certainly doesn't feel like a guarantee that there's going to be more than one bid.
Sitting here in August, I'll pick two right now. And the biggest reason is for how disappointing the last few years have been for the conference. Last year was still a massive, massive anomaly in that we walked into the A10 tournament without a surefire at-large bid team. And we've seen time and time again that when that happens in this conference, if there's only one, that team is not winning the A10 tournament. We're going to end up with a bid thief if that's what's necessary to get that second bid. So I feel confident that someone out of the group between Dayton, VCU, Fordham, St. Joe's, St. Bonaventure, Duquesne, one of them will be good enough to get an at-large bid. And then if it's just that team, they will get pummeled on Saturday or Sunday at the A10 tournament.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hope, I think. And I do think there's a good chance that there's going to be one at-large team in the A10. I don't think there's going to be two. I just don't know if there's going to be enough good wins to go around. And I don't know how many teams have the type of ceiling where it just feels like for someone like Duquesne, everything's going to have to go right for them to get an at-large bid. And maybe that can happen to them. I don't see it happening to multiple teams, though. I do have to hold out hope that it is going to be better. Like you said, last year was the worst in years, and I'm not too worried that's a trend for the future that we need to worry about every year. But it's not going to be seven bids. I'll answer that part of the question.
I
That
don't
should be
think it
pretty
ever
simple.
was. It was six, but
It's been six. Yeah, that feels like such a long time ago, but somehow it happened. All right, West Pine Bills wanted us to discuss the team that will rise the most in the standings and will fall the most. So I'll start out. I think the team that will rise the most in the standings, it feels like Loyola is the easiest pick just because they have the most ground to move up, finishing in 15th last year, and they are getting picked in the middle of the pack by a decent number of people right now. So they at least feel like a safe pick. I think for the other part of the question, there's a whole bunch of teams you could talk about, though.
yeah, Loyola is an easy pick, and I'm going to take that easy pick. They're going to jump at least seven spots. It might not be much more than that, but
Maybe. I
like
wouldn't say it's a guarantee, but
I feel like they've put together a great high floor veteran core. That's and we've talked about this with Kevin Sweeney and in other spaces on this show, but I just feel like they're getting back to what made them successful in the past. And if they're the team that I believe they are, then they're really not going to be any worse than maybe slightly below 500. And so, given how bad they were last year, that's a half a standings leap. And I don't love any of the teams that were down in the pillow fight with them last season. So, in terms of teams that'll drop, sorry guys, I got to take St. Louis. And this is a team that, and they kind of remind me of a better version of how we've talked about some of the LaSalle teams in the last few years, where there's a lot of pieces that I like, but I feel like a lot of those guys are going to have to play in better roles than what they should be. Like if Gibson Jimerson's my third guy who can carry me on a heat check four or five times a year and is a fringe all-conference player, and that's what I'm expecting from him, I would love that. Like it, you put him as the guy on as the best wing on Dayton with Malachi and Deron Holmes, that would be incredible. But unless he turns back into Boise State game of 2 years ago, Jimerson, the guy who for a half a dozen straight games was an incredible off the bounce attacker. And he's shown it in pieces, but he hasn't shown it consistently ever since then. Unless he does that, he can't be the best player on a successful team. And I don't see who else would possibly be their best player. And then I look just kind of all over the roster, like other best case scenarios. Like, can Larry Hughes Jr. and Sincere Parker both be quality starters? Well, I really like Larry Hughes Jr., but it still kind of bugs me that he was a walk-on last year. Like, it makes me want to think twice about the high ceiling I'm putting on him, that he wasn't even a scholarship player last year. It just makes me hesitate. And even some of these freshmen, like if they get a great contribution from Medley early on and from Bruce Sang, and Hargrove's a great sixth or seventh man to have, but just where does that take you? Like, who are your other top three players? And just as I keep reading it off, it just feels like a team that's kind of capped somewhere in the 7-10 seed range.
Yeah, I think I'd agree St. Louis is almost definitely dropping, even though they are just the consistent fourth place team in the A-10 these days. But I do think, just given Travis Ford's track record, I don't think they're going to bottom out and contend for the basement. I think they'll still win at least 7, 8, 9 conference games. I look at George Mason, though, finishing fifth right below them, and losing Oduro, losing a whole bunch of other seniors and their coach, it's kind of hard to project what they're going to look like, but I'd say George Mason has a much lower floor than St. Louis. I'd also even say, I mean, GW finished seventh last year, and I don't think they're going to be terrible, but if you look at the projections on T-Rank, they are by far the lowest ranked A-10 team, and James Bishop was amazing last year. They bring back the rookie of the year, Maximus Edwards. But other than that, it's a very green team. And so I'd say the two Georges just are going to be volatile and wouldn't be that surprised to see one of them really struggle next year. So I'd say George Mason, just since they finished higher and have more to drop off. But I mean, there's a lot. Even you could say Fordham finishing third, just since they set such a high bar last year. They have a long way to go down too if they don't recover from losing two of their seniors.
I just think where GW finished, for them to be the answer, like, they have to be a clear bottom three team.
That could happen.
And I just don't think, but we've seen this before. Like, when you have two dudes who are as good as Bishop and Edwards, like, even if the rest of your roster is terrible, like, you're just going to be okay, no matter what. Like, their worst case scenario is probably somewhere in the 10, 11, 12 range. Basically, the answer to this question is just kind of, who do you think is going to be the worst between St. Louis, Duquesne, Fordham, George Mason? And I'm so glad that you brought up George Mason, because I saw someone, I forget who it was, had them dead last in their rankings.
I think it was Rothstein, wasn't it?
It might have been. I don't think they're a pillow fight team.
Really?
And I think what happened with George Mason is everyone saw the headlines early. English leaves. He takes Oduro with him. He takes ticket gains. He takes the promising Fernandez. Freshman and Justin Fernandez. Polite was in the portal for a while. And then all of a sudden, it's early April, and they still don't have a coach. And their roster is basically just like Malik Henry, and maybe Devin Dinkins might be coming back. And so if you're someone who's not heavily paying attention to George Mason, as I'm sure a solid chunk of the people listening right now aren't, you don't realize how great of a job Tony Skin did kind of rescuing this roster from the pillow fight in April and May. They brought in a lot of interesting veteran transfers, including one that I want to talk about more in depth later in this episode to answer someone else's question. But he gets Polite back. I think he's a surefire all-conference player. And I just look around this roster, and my biggest conclusion is actually the opposite of what you said. I think they do have a decently high floor, because there's just a lot of guys who are going to be solid players. And they brought in a lot of veteran, solid transfers in a way that St. Louis didn't. And it's funny, I mentioned the Rams Rewind episode earlier, where they bring up that Kawani Kawani was down to VCU and St. Louis. And St. Louis tried to push him for a quick decision, and maybe he would have gone to VCU anyway, but like that's the kind of guy St. Louis needs. He's just a dude that I know is going to contribute for them, and George Mason found a bunch of them. And that's why I feel better about them than the Billikens at this point. Plus, honestly, I think I just like Polite slightly more than Jimerson.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think George Mason, too, they're just kind of in the zone where having a new coach and so many new players, it's hard to project right now. But wouldn't be all that surprised to see Tony Skin keep it rolling with the guys he brought in. The one other team, too, we kind of jumped from it, but for the team that could rise the most, I think Loyola still is the safest answer. But the caveat is if St. Joe's manages to go from like 10th to 2nd. I don't think that's going to happen, but
yeah, but this isn't it's show possible. That's going to make that projection.
Yeah. Nah, I can't go there, but
you got to go to like a Hawk Hill Hardwood Spaces for that kind of optimism.
Exactly. You're not going to get it here. Not yet. All right. Speaking of off-season additions though, we got a question from Joel. What coaches help themselves in the off-season and who is on the hot seat? So I would say overall, I mean, Billy Lang, we already talked about. I don't think he was getting fired anyway, but I think he helped himself both with the strong finish last year and bringing in some good freshmen. Although I'm not sure if you'd say that happened over the off season. It was earlier in the process, but he seems like the coach who was on the hottest seat last year and feels a bit safer now, although it still, like we said, it has more to do with what happens over the next several months.
I'll be brief because we already talked about Billy Lang, and he's the answer to both.
Mm-hmm.
He helped himself in the offseason keeping that roster, making it basically a no-brainer for them to keep him, and setting up excitement and expectations to the point now that I think if they slightly disappoint, if they're a fifth, sixth place team, but they're consistently above 500, you feel like they're a title contender for a whiff in January, he probably keeps his job as long as most of the roster stays next year. Now, on the flip side, the expectations have now been set that if they're a middle of the pack team, even though that's an improvement over what they've been, he's probably done. And I couldn't really think of anybody else who's on the hot seat. Like,
I don't think there is. Like, there's so many.
If you're St. Louis, like, if you're going to fire Travis Ford, if they're bad this year with the talent that you knew they were going to bring back, then mm-hmm. you just never should have brought him back in the first place. Like, you should either fired him last offseason, or you got to wait a few years now.
Yeah, I mean, I really just think with how many A-10 coaches are either in their first or second year, and most of the long-tenured guys are pretty successful. I just don't think anyone else is on the hot seat.
Anthony Grant's not getting fired.
Like, no, Anthony Grant's not getting fired. I don't think Travis Ford is either.
Yeah, I don't think either of them are.
So, yeah, I mean, I think Billy Lang's the only one you could consider for this right now. Although, I mean, certainly could change once these coaches get through their second season. Like, I mean, even guys like Archie Miller and Frank Martin, like, I think they're in no danger whatsoever. But if one of them has another just dreadful season.
Yeah, but it's all like,
that's all hypothetical.
You're a year away from being a year away, where it's like,
exactly.
Frank Martin just pisses off the wrong people this season and they're bad. Or if Loyola is just a disaster again.
Mm-hmm.
Or if the only other one, and I hesitate to say it because I think it's so unlikely, but if Duquesne just takes a massive step back this season, that's the one where there could be a change. But I just think that this roster is just too talented for that to even really be entertained as a thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think just the way the league shapes up right now, I don't think there's anybody that needs to worry this year. Now, going into next season, it wouldn't be as surprising because somebody's got to finish last this year, and that'll answer some more questions. But yeah, right now,
somebody's butt's going to be on fire at this time next year.
Right.
But that same person is going to be employed.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think so. All right, just a couple more here. Connor Bailey from the Black and Gold Fan podcast wanted us to pick a returning A10 player that will have a breakout season. And it had to be someone who averaged single digit scoring. And when I looked at this, I kind of did a double take that Will Richardson only averaged 6.6 points, but he seems like a pretty easy pick for me right now.
I felt like I was cheating because I'm putting Will Richardson on my preseason all conference team.
Wow.
But like he's look at his path. He's a highly touted recruit who couldn't really get on the court in the non-con and then really took off once he started getting big minutes in January, February. Like it feels too obvious of a pick. And I struggled to come up with a veteran here. Like all the other names that popped into my head were other returning sophomores. Kareem Rozier, I've talked about that one at length. He's up there. Larry Hughes Jr., Jalen Quinn, I think just as a change of pace, spark plug on a team that's going to be really slow and deliberate, and he's going to bring them something that no one else does. Brandon Weston, who's kind of like the anti-Jalen Quinn, who's just going to be really strong in every other way for a roadie team that's just going to need any player who's solid. But I do have one veteran who reminds me in a way of Keyshawn Curry, who is a name that I think Connor will be delighted to hear, as just a guy who was a really solid athlete for a long time in his career. And now this guy's been a better player to this point than Keyshawn Curry was going into his senior season. But he's not good enough to be a Vince Williams candidate where he's like a first team all conference guy. He fits somewhere in between. And that's Grant Huffman, who everyone's talking about Angelo Brizzi. He's the point guard of the future. He's going to be running the show from day one. I don't think that's true. If Matt McKillop is anything like his father, he is not giving the keys to the car to a freshman when he has a proven point guard option already on his roster. And I think early on in this season, as the young guys developed, Grant Huffman is going to be Davidson's best player. And I think he's a potential all-conference guy. And you just look at what he's been able to do. He has grown as an offensive player as he takes more and more of a role throughout his career. He had more assists in conference play last year than Foster Lawyer did. Like that, it's a stat that still astounds me to this day. Now, he's still not making his threes, but despite shooting under 25% from deep, he still found a way to shoot 47% from the field. Like, this is a guy who just gets better and better with more responsibility. And I expect him to be a low double-digit scorer next year with probably upwards of five assists.
Yeah, I think that's a good pick, and definitely he's going to have the opportunity this year. But one more veteran I thought of, and this is someone who's kind of just been blocked on the depth chart his entire career, and now he's going to be on his third coach. But I'm really interested to see what Malik Henry does at George Mason, someone who's pretty much come off the bench his entire career, but seems like he'll have the path to playing time without Josh Oduor there. And just felt like there were a couple times just sporadically in conference play where Oduor would get into foul trouble and Henry would come off the bench with a huge game. He had, 15 points a couple times. So he's also just been highly touted from the time he stepped on campus as a great shot blocker. And I don't know. I think if you're looking for an experienced veteran that has never put up any sort of eye-popping stats in their career, it seems like he'll have the chance to make a big jump with more playing time.
That's a perfect guy that I'm 100% confident will put up better numbers this year. I think he was one of their five best players last year. And I would love to know what the relationship was like between him and Kim English because there were nights late in the season where he literally was not seeing the court. And he was just better than Ojiako and anyone else they wanted to go with at the big spots, Blake Jones or playing small when Oduor was off the court. I didn't get it. I thought he was a really important piece for them down the stretch. And his minutes just didn't reflect that last season. So if Skin trusts him, that's a guy that I definitely believe will be better with more minutes.
Yeah, and I mean, you talk about too with the additions George Mason had, most of them were guards and wings. So I think he'll have the opportunity. And last year it was just always tough to figure out what his role was on the team, but seems like we should have a clearer picture this year. But another question, just talking about newcomers now to the conference. Jay Catsby, aka the Achille Spadone Stan account, wanted us to pick the best newcomers, and we'll each do a transfer and freshman. So I feel like we're still kind of at the stage where I'm biased towards the guys we've spent more time talking about. But when it comes to newcomers, I'm still tantalized by Kreese DeSondico's potential at St. Joe's. And there's some other good ones. I think Miles Rubin at Loyola Chicago is another good example, but I think that's where I need to start on this question.
So I intentionally don't want to talk about the guys that we've already kind of covered in depth.
I know I
Both
took the easy way out.
Esendoko and Max Scholga and Sean Bairstow, Demi Adelokun over at Loyola. Like there's a whole bunch of guys that are probably at the top that we've kind of already covered. Josh Rivera at Fordham, who we've both probably gotten unnecessarily high on. I'm missing a few, like the Duquesne big men. So two guys that came to mind for me that we have not discussed. Oh, Josh Cohen's another one who's going to be all conference, but we've covered that already. George Mason, I want to go back to them. This is the guy that I teased like 15 minutes ago. They're bringing in a transfer from Virginia Tech and Darius Maddox, who reminds me a lot of Deshaun Schwartz 2 years ago. Coming from a very similar situation, played big minutes on a good power conference team in what was really a limited role as in terms of what he was entrusted to do on the court. And there's nothing particularly special about Maddox's game. He's a very solid defender without being elite. He's a decent rebounder for his skinny 6'5" frame. Not a great shooter last year in a starting role, but he's a guy that just continually found ways to contribute for a good program. And you look at some of his best games, just like with Schwartz, he showed up in the big time a few times. 20 points on 4 or 5 from three against North Carolina in the ACC semifinals 2 years ago. Earlier that year, at Miami, end of February, with their at large hopes teetering on the brink. 5 for 7 shooting, 3 of 5 from three, 13 points, and a huge win that kind of kept Virginia Tech on the right side of the bubble before they went and won the ACC tournament and solidified their chances. Even their opening game, an overtime game against Clemson, found a way to contribute 8 points on 2 of 3 from deep. And it's a guy who just feels like he just shouldn't be on a mid-tier A-10 team. Like, I don't know what Darius Maddox is going to do. I don't think we have the proof to believe that he's going to jump down to this level and be a star. But this is a guy that I know could contribute to a good Power Five team because he's already done it. And maybe he's George Mason's second best player, third best player. I don't know what that means for them from a ceiling standpoint. But that's a guy that I know we're going to talk about a bunch throughout this season.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. And I think overall, too, just with transfers, a lot of experienced guys coming into the conference. I think Scholga and Bairstow over at VCU, they feel like the safest picks to be good, just since they are coming from a great team and keeping their same coach. But, given that we have already talked about them, one guy I'm super interested to see is Enoch Cheeks going to Dayton. Just because this was a team, especially with their injuries last year to at the guard position, just felt like they were consistently a step slower than the other team. And Cheeks definitely will provide some more athleticism and quickness on the perimeter. I'm especially interested by his defensive abilities. Last year, top 10 in the Horizon League, both in block rate and steal rate. So just seems like a really versatile all-around player, gives the Flyers some much needed guard depth, and he's also going to provide a lot more scoring. at 15 points a game last year. I don't think he's going to get quite to that level, but going to give the Flyers another threat on the outside. And just given with what we saw happen to the Flyers last year, you can't have too many guards. And I think it'll just be crucial for them to have another good ball handler.
Yeah, that's another guy we kind of talked about a little bit earlier. And you look at what he was at Robert Morris as a inconsistent but still strong outside shooter, a good slasher, an athletic defender who could guard all over the perimeter. And basically at Robert Morris, he did what everyone expected Kobe Elvis to do at Dayton last year. And they need a guy like that. And now it just gives them so much more optionality that between someone who did it consistently at a lower level in Cheeks and someone who did it inconsistently at this level in Elvis, one of them is going to have to do it throughout the year. Dayton has to have that guy next to Malachi Smith, but that's somebody I'm pretty high on as well. And one other thing I meant to throw in with Maddox, I don't want this to go uncovered. 51% from three on two attempts a game as a critical high minutes bench guy for them when they made the tournament 2 years ago. Last year as a starter, 32%. So we'll see which one of those guys shows up for George Mason. If it's the guy from 2 years ago, combined with everything else he's been able to do, that's a fringe all conference guy. So.
All right. I think we can wrap it up here with the mailbag at the very bottom.
Who's your freshman?
Oh, I'm still going Chris DeSonico. I'm okay. Not being creative. Do you have
I got mine. A young man, and this was one of the final commits into the conference. And by the way, VCU fans, I kind of wanted to talk about Michael Bell, but I just keep looking at the depth chart. And if Famasil is eligible, I think Michael Bell's a let's invest in him next year guy. Minutes are just going to be tough to come by for him. But one young guy who I think when people break out his team step chart are going to be surprised at how many minutes he's going to have a chance to go earn early in the season. A Lithuanian by the name of Petros Pajimas. I don't even know how to pronounce his last name yet because David Jablonski hasn't done a video with him yet. Dayton's final recruit, a guy who has not only played on the highest levels of the FIBA U16, 17, 18 circuit for what I'm not sure people realize, incredibly basketball hungry nation in Lithuania. But he has played extremely well at that level. He's been a starter for those teams three straight years, climbing through the age groups, capping it off 7 points, 6.5 rebounds in six games this year at the U18 Euro Championships. 20 points, 9 rebounds against Israel, or sorry, against Sweden in their group, in one of their group play games. He was a double-digit scorer on a team that made a run to the semifinals in the U17 World Championships last year. Would have made the finals if they didn't run into a Team USA squad that's filled with soon-to-be lottery picks. He's 6'9". He moves well at the rim. If you look at his highlight videos, this is a guy who catches a lot of alley-oops. He's got good finishing skills around the hoop, which is going to be crucial for a team that doesn't have a lot of slashers, doesn't have many guys who are going to be able to score at the rim besides Deron Holmes. And for a 6'9 built guy, his shot looks about as good from deep as you're going to get for someone of that archetype. He's going to give them some decent floor spacing. He's definitely going to hit the boards. I think this could be a significant key piece as a starter for Dayton as the year goes on. And they don't have many big forwards. It's basically him, Nate Santos, Simi Nokeji. I think he's going to be able to win a big role early on, be able to make his mistakes on the court. And from everything I've seen in my short research on him, absolutely picking him as an all-rookie player for next season.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good pick, just given the opportunity he's going to have. And really for Dayton, it seems like between him and Jayon Simon, one of those guys will get a lot of minutes on the wing. So
I think he's going to actually play the four if he gets big minutes.
Yeah, certainly possible. I mean, Dayton has a second round draft picks sized hole at the power forward position. So they're going to need a lot of production from whoever steps in and replaces Tumani Kamara. All right. Well, now we will get to the last and maybe the best question of the night from Ryan Paleo, GW. And that's all. So where do you want to take this one, Tyler?
Can we just start calling Maximus Edwards the Gladiator? He's going to have a great season anyway, but it's a killer nickname that I think is necessary for him to really unlock his all-conference potential.
I'm here for it. I think we tried to start that a little bit last year, and I mean, he's coming off a big season. He's certainly going to be great. I am completely blanking. What is GW's new team name? Are they the Revolutionaries?
They are.
They needed something more memorable.
We did a whole segment about this.
I know, that was months ago. I'm excited for GW. That's all I'm going to say. I know I was kind of down on them earlier. I said they were a candidate to drop the most in the standings, but I still think the Chris Caputo era is going to be exciting. I think he's got the program headed in the right direction. And, you know, I hope to be proven wrong, because looking on paper, outside of Edwards and Bishop, I'm not thrilled about the roster. But last year, they surprised us all and ended up with a top half finish. So that's certainly possible again. And it'll be a fun season to play out for the Revs.
I got nothing else for that. I want to keep my answer short and sweet to Paleo's great question. But I still have one more question written down, and we have to answer it because he is actually still listening at this point. Tristan Freeman asked, with Deron Holmes, the preseason player of the year, which teams are best equipped to deal with him or at least prevent him from going off? And this question, when you think about the answer, kind of goes to show you why the A-10's taken a little bit of a step down in the last few years. The great defensive centers are gone. I don't think there's one player in this conference who is well set to guard Deron Holmes one-on-one unless a clone of Deron Holmes was able to face him. He's by far the best defensive center in the league. And so you look at teams that have a combination of a lot of big bodies who can be physical with him, with coaches who will be able to throw clever defensive schemes like VCU did last season to make him either be denied the ball or make him catch the ball in tough spots. And so I look at Duquesne as someone, they have a lot of big bodies. They're going to be able to rough him up, send him to the foul line. He still can't shoot foul shots. So why not? Duquesne's got like 19 big guys on their team. And Dan Brodt will be more than happy to have everybody just kind of give him his lumps. Now, interestingly, Trey Williams really didn't guard him when they played last year because it was so early in the season. He's probably one of the better equipped players in the league to take him on one-on-one. But my big answer is Fordham. They have Abdusam Billah coming back. They have Elijah Gray coming back. And Keith Ergo is going to want to get physical with him. He will be more than happy to do that. And Abdusam Billah at his size is probably one of the best equipped players in the league to give Deron Holmes trouble on that end.
Fordham was my initial thought, but then I also just remembered how Deron Holmes torched them twice, once in the A-10 tournament for 20 points, and then he also had a 32-point game at Rose Hill. But still, I mean, that's always an imposing defensive front court. I think Duquesne, just because of the sheer volume they can throw at Holmes, will present a challenge. And then I feel like Loyola's still bringing in Adelican, Patrick Mwamba. They're going to have some more size.
They're another team that can throw a lot of bodies and will play him physical.
Yeah, I mean, those are the three that come to mind, but it's going to be tough. And I do think, as Tristan said, he is going to be the preseason player of the year. He's the toughest matchup for anybody on paper at this stage. So it'll be interesting to see where he can build on from last season's success and how teams are going to try to shut him down.
Sneaky matchup I already want to see, and it's dependent on him staying healthy this year and taking a big step up. But if we get the best version of Khalil Barre this season, that's somebody who actually really could cause Holmes some problems. because he can move and he's actually somehow more muscular than Holmes. But he's got a lot to learn on the defensive end because at this point, Holmes is going to be able to play some tricks on him.
Well, apologies to Tristan for missing his question. That's a good reminder for me to check the DMs, replies, and the quote tweets because I missed that one. But
yeah, overall, Tristan, don't quote. Just reply, dude.
Yeah, I had no idea that was out there, but I hope I had a good answer off the cuff there. So thank you to everyone, though. That was a great list of questions, especially for an off-season episode. Tyler, anything else you want to cover on this one?
No, this is a long episode, but it's the middle of August. There's no other good pods out. So you guys can keep listening for Lil Bona X. He's going to give us some great St. Bonaventure takes, and then we're going to talk about a little bit of I Think You Should Leave season 3. So, Matt, anything else you want to throw in before we send it over to him?
Not really. I hope the A10's good this year because it was fun talking about all this stuff, but it's not going to be fun if it's February and it's clearly going to be a one big league. So let's win some non-conference games. I'll just reiterate that one more time tonight.
Yeah, let's actually just sign off with that for every show between now and Thanksgiving, because it's going to be true over and over and over again. And we just got the brackets for a bunch of the tournaments today, and I see UMass in the Diamond Head bracket, and I'm just reminded of GW going 0-3 against a bad field there last year. That's why we were all so surprised that they ended up in the middle, because they ended the non-con so badly. And they were not the only ones who disappointed those first 2 months. So hopefully less teams do this season.
Nowhere to go but up.
Yeah, everybody stick around. Lil Bona X coming up next. All right, I am now joined by the Western New York man of mystery, Lil Bona X, here to talk about this upcoming St. Bonaventure season that has gotten really interesting with the addition of two transfers. X, thank you for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm glad you're finally getting the real big game boomer on, of course.
Of course, the truest of big game boomers.
I am the one true big game boomer.
Who knows? We might see your buddy Olympics Rothstein a year from now. Could that be implied?
Yeah. He may be going to Paris.
Yeah, you're going to have to give us all a warning on that. Go check out his Twitter account at Lil Bona X if you haven't already. We'll just plug that right now.
Or but, Blue Sky. Yeah, preferably Blue Sky.
Blue Sky, which I kind of forgot existed here for a little bit. But we'll get A10.
I got a
Blue
code
Sky
if you want.
Here,
I got so a code yesterday if you want one.
We'll talk after we record.
All right.
So let's go into this. So St. Bonaventure brings back their entire starting lineup, but adds a pair of grad transfers. That just sounds terrible. But
it makes sense nowadays. Yeah. It really does.
These are two guys, Charles Pride, a second team all conference in the America East, Micah Adams Woods, the starting point guard for Cincinnati. Like, these are not players who are showing up to a mid-major just to play limited minutes off the bench in their final season. So we'll kind of skip over opening night because, as I talked about in one of the earlier segments with the mailbag, that lineup's definitely going to change. But let's say best case scenario, when March rolls around, who do you think are going to be the five guys that Mark Schmidt's leaning on?
First off, I'm very disappointed that we're not going to be breaking down Longwood basketball because that's who the Bonnies are opening against.
We can do that before we're done, but
Please don't. I know absolutely nothing about Longwood other than that they're called the Lancers. They made the tournament like 2 years ago, but I think we're going to see at the beginning pretty much the same five, except maybe Adams Woods getting mixed in over Moses Flowers. So that would be, you know, Daryl Banks the third, Cairo Luke. Well, no, Adams Woods would take Luke's place. I'm sorry. Daryl Banks the third, Adams Woods. I'd say Jan Farrell will be the three, and then you'll have, I guess Charles Pride would take over Barry Evans too. So I think you'll see Adams Woods and Pride start from day one, because even though Schmidt's had a pretty tough time of breaking his lineup, I do think he has been able to allow impact transfers to start right from basically day one, whether you look at Jaron Holmes and Jalen Attaway, and of course Banks and Luke from last season. So I really think they're going to need to get a lot more down low in order to stay consistent because of the foul trouble we saw with Chad Venning and just needing to replace the defense that Oshuni left with. And that will come with Noel Brown, who's, by the way, shout out to GW. Thank you for letting Noel Brown come to the Enchanted Mountains.
Yeah, another big guy who can provide some shot blocking and rebounding, but doesn't really move that much. St. Bonaventure has had a ton of them on their bench lately, but I completely agree with you. I would be very surprised if Moses Flowers keeps his starting spot, even going into the year, certainly by the end of the season. It seems
that's
like
nothing
Schmidt
to take
liked...
away from him, though. I mean, yeah. he earned his spot towards the end, and there's no reason why he may, you know, he may take off the season and be, and Adams Woods could be the sixth man. I think there's going to be some good depth at guard, especially.
Yeah, and I think Schmidt, and this is funny to say because this is the man who doesn't want to use his bench, but I think Schmidt liked having Flowers as his sixth man, and really kind of waited until he just reached a point that he had to play him more minutes over Barry Evans when Evans just wasn't making shots late in the season before he made that change. But I'm most specifically interested in the point guard spot. I was just enamored with Lightning Luke back in the non-conference last year, and he just didn't keep up the same level of play once they got into the A-10. And you could even see in February when Brett Rumpel was back and actually playing full time, he was taking more and more Luke's minutes. Well, Rumpel's gone now. You bring in Adams Woods in his place. And one of the toughest things for me to figure out with the St. Bonaventure season is, what does Cairo Luke's role end up looking like when we get into the crunch time of it?
I think he's going to contribute more than last season. I know I was kind of thinking on the fly about who the starting five would be on the opening night, but I wonder if Schmidt got into the situation where Daryl Banks is basically like the Iron Man 5 from 2 years ago, where he can play 40 minutes a night and he looks a little gassed at times, and I don't think he should be playing 39, 40 minutes a night, but he can give it to you. Whereas Luke is not necessarily the same player because he may move a lot more, and so he expends a lot more energy. So you may only get 30 minutes a night out of Luke, which is more than fine. So I think you're going to need to see whether it would be Adams Woods or Banks step up as a point guard, or even Moses Flowers. Somebody will have to share those responsibilities, because I don't see Cairo Luke being the next Kyle Lofton and just playing 45 minutes in a 40-minute game, as Unfurled and I like joking about.
Yeah, and it's the perimeter depth overall that's really going to help this team if they use it. As we know with Schmidt, he might not. But what I'm most curious about with the newcomers, how do you see Adams Woods and Pride being able to contribute? How good are these guys going to be in the A-10? And really kind of leading to the question of, if Daryl Banks is off, because we saw once out of every five games, Daryl Banks can beat anybody for you. But once or twice out of those other four, he's going to be awful. The shots aren't falling. It's going to be like a 1-for-12 shooting game. And the Bonnies just couldn't adapt in those situations. Can these guys take off some of that load? Can Charles Pride be a go-to scorer on a Daryl Banks off night?
I think Pride's going to have to be that, since he's undersized at 6'4", but he's going to be the slashing three guard forward that the Bonnies really lacked last season. Jan Farrell is not exactly that type. He can step out and hit threes, but I feel like he's a little bit more prone to playing down low. Whereas, at least from what I've, you know, read up on with Charles Pride, it seems like he's somebody who can stretch the floor, make more cuts to the basket, and kind of just you know, take some of that scoring load off of Banks, because Banks had plenty of times when he could not create his own shot because most teams keyed on him as the only legitimate scoring threat throughout way too long of stretches of the season, unfortunately.
Yeah, and games like that happen to him all the time at St. Peter's. You look back at his game log there, and it was this crazy roller coaster. And everyone remembers the first round against Kentucky. He goes for 20-plus points. He did that multiple times last year. That's what got him into the all-conference conversation. But he kind of was the same guy at Bonaventure as he was at St. Peter's. And we now have 3 years worth of track record to say he'll probably be close to the same again this year.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think maybe he can be more efficient if he has another scoring threat, because he can be hot from deep, of course. But I do wonder how often he's able to convert when he's driving into the lane. So that may be something where Charles Pride and even Adams Woods to some extent could take over some of that load, because Kyrell Luke's way too undersized and needs to be more of a facilitator to do that.
Yeah, and that backcourt is certainly where all the intrigue is coming from. That's where all of the conversation over the next few months is going to be about the Bonnies. So I want to shift it to the two returning starters in the front court, Chad Venning and Jan Farrell. And they're backed up by basically, like you said, Noel Brown. And if Barry Evans is going to play some backup 4 minutes like he did last year. But those are the two guys that seem like they're pretty set in their roles. So I want to see from you, as someone who watched every waking moment of Bonaventure basketball last year.
Don't remind me.
Well, and got to see those two guys get better as the season went on, though. What do you expect from them this year? Is there another leap coming? Because, like, for Chad Venning, I think he's already exceeded the best expectations, at least for outsiders.
By the way, I went to, I think, 5 games last season, and they lost all 5. So, unfortunately, I did watch way too much of it. But I do think that, getting back to your question, I think that Venning is going to be an all-conference candidate. I don't know if he's going to be, you know, I wouldn't go player of the year, but he is going to be a force down low. He is 10 times the offensive scoring threat that Oshuni was. And all that he needs to do is get a little more conditioned and a little better at staying out of foul trouble, which is always easier said than done with big men. But maybe with the emergence of even Melian Martinez, who's a big man, he could emerge to give him a few extra minutes. And Noel Brown, as we mentioned, who's a seasoned vet. He knows the A-10. He knows the nonsense that happens in this wonderful conference. So I think Venning and Banks need a little bit less of the load on them. Not to say that they're incapable of leading a team, but I think they were keyed on too many times. When Banks's shots weren't falling, they were just kicking it into Venning, and he was, you know, trying to back guys down. I think with this season, the Bonnies can have more of a dynamic scoring threat where it doesn't have to just be Banks threes or Venning post moves. Because while the analytics may say it's always supposed to be three-pointers and dunks, or three-pointers and layups, or whatever, what have you, you need to have more dynamicness to your offense. You need to be able to create shots. You need to be able to have guys get to the line. And that's something that the team lacked. And so I think Venning having a little bit less of a workload, thanks to Noel Brown especially, that could definitely help. As for, you wanted to talk about Jan Farrell too. I don't know which one. I mean, I'm not an insider, so I haven't seen these guys practicing. I could see either Farrell or Barry Evans really taking a huge step. I don't think it'll be both. I do think it'll be one, and if I had to guess, I would say Farrell, because I think he's a little more of a complete basketball product, but it wouldn't surprise me if either one really stepped forward. And, you know, hopefully both of them can get some minutes in Schmidt's offense, because I think both guys are very talented.
Yeah, I'd certainly lean towards Farrell, and the numbers by the end of the season support that claim. Farrell was taking up basically all of those minutes at that kind of flex forward spot next to Moses Flowers. But I want to go back to Chad Venning as potential all-conference player, just for a moment of just kind of letting it soak in how crazy that statement would have sounded 11 months ago. He played 15 minutes in your opener last year. This was a 14-minute-a-game guy in the MEAC 2 years ago. So
yep.
He has certainly already just gone way over what I think people ever expected from him. But it's an interesting take, and the only other thing I can think of is you mentioned the depth behind him and giving him a blow. The name Linton Brown just kept popping into my head. We get excited yep. about Bonaventure backups, and the next thing we know, they're back in junior college. So,
yeah, I mean, it's frustrating because, yeah, I think Linton Brown, downtown Linton Brown, would have really taken another step forward. I said that about Alejandro Vasquez a few years ago. It's
Alejandro Vasquez.
Oh, he was the wild card. He's like Charlie from It's Always Sunny when they're what episode, I forgot what episode it is, but then he's like, he's the wild card.
The gas every crisis.
The gas crisis. He's like, every crew needs a wild card. He is a wild card. But yeah, going back to Venning, I'm just quickly looking at his game log. The only, how many games is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6? I think it's 10 out of his last 11 games, he scored double figures. And the only one was 9 points against Davidson. So he definitely took a step forward. He scored 22 in that thrilling overtime comeback and unfortunate loss to GW. He really took a step forward. And I think it's going to have to be a little bit less of a workload on him as that we saw at some of those games. Like I remember Iona, he was like relied on way too heavily and it wasn't going to happen. There are probably a couple other games I'm forgetting where he was keyed on too much and it didn't help the offense stay fluid. So I do think Venning can continue to grow as an offensive threat. I think he did extremely well against Daron Holmes in Dayton, and that was easily the Bonnies' best win of the season, as we now expect Dayton to be the front runner. And VCU was also a really good win too, but he definitely was the main key to winning that Dayton game. So I think there's a potential for him. I'm not going to say, you know, first team, second team, third team, but he can definitely get into that all-conference conversation.
Yeah, in that single-digit game against Davidson, he actually fouled out, so that kind of explains part of it. But
yeah, but he still had 9 points.
Yeah, he almost got to that threshold.
But if you look at this fouling out, going back to the fouling point, three of his last seven games he fouled out of, including that Davidson game. So that's going to be the big key. And I mean, I feel like we talk about that with every big man, but especially him since he's not very mobile and fouls can come easily when you're getting beat on plays.
Yeah, I mean, I got the game log up too. Like it flashes back in my head. Him fouling out with, I think it was like 3.5 to go against Duquesne in Palumbo was not the reason that they lost the game, but it was probably the biggest reason.
That was like, that game was like us, the U.S. losing to Sweden on penalties, and they took the VAR and they showed how the ball was over the line by like a millimeter. That's how it was with that tip-in from, I believe it was Jan Farrell, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, that tip-in was like 0.002 seconds away from forcing overtime.
Yeah, I almost, I think I told this on the pod, but I can't remember because it was so long ago. I was on the complete opposite side of the court when that happened.
Oh, you were there?
Yeah, so I was texting people. I was texting people trying to get like a replay because I couldn't get it up on my phone quick enough. I almost jumped up to just go like walk behind the NBC broadcast spot just to see if I could catch a glimpse on the announcer's monitors over there.
Oh my God. Yeah, because they probably wouldn't show any replays in the arena.
They really
can afford Uber Eats, but they can't afford a replay scoreboard, right?
you'll love this as a Duquesne hater, but they used to run replays constantly, like a good decade ago, and they have stopped doing that almost entirely now.
Really?
So it's not that they don't have the technology.
So what you're saying is Keith Dambra is suppressing First Amendment rights. I got it.
Very possible.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll go ahead and go the other way and credit my some extended family member. I think he's like a second cousin who was running the video camera at the time they started doing replay and hasn't done that in a long time. So
okay,
I'll say that he was the reason.
Nice.
But we'll carry on here. So who do you think ends up being the Bonnies' best player this season? Is it Chad Venning?
I still think it's Darryl Banks. It really is. He's going to have to be the player who I think the Bonnies even lacked a few years ago when, you know, if Kyle Lofton wasn't having a great three-point shooting night and they needed a, lack of a better way of putting it with a cliche, a stone-cold killer from three. They didn't really have that, especially in 2022. Banks can clearly be that, as he's proven in plenty of times. And I really think that's going to be important for the Bonnies is to have somebody who can hit the clutchest of shots. Now, Banks, you know, there weren't unfortunately many clutch moments last season, but I think if the Bonnies are thrown into that situation, he'll be able to do that. And once he becomes more of an offensive threat, I think that'll open up things for other guys because as we saw throughout last season, plenty of times he was getting double teamed and maybe even triple teamed where because there was no real offensive threat. And honestly, I would have kept two guys on him every time because not many Bonnies were scoring last season. It was a very, very, very poor offensive season. So if there can be that emergence of other threats, then I think Banks will really take off.
Yeah, personally, I think Pride can be a good pairing for him as some sort of 1-2 kind of all over the court scoring punch. And they really need it. That offense was mediocre or worse in every category you could look at last year, except they just didn't turn the ball over that much. It's the one thing that they were good at, finishing in the top 100 in turnover rate.
I'm stunned you said that. It felt like they turned over the ball every 3 minutes or every 3 seconds or something.
Then you look at their defense, they forced a ton of turnovers and were great defending the 3-point line, but were horrible defending the two and mediocre at everything else. So it was winning the turnover margin that really kind of powered the Bonnies.
Yeah, I don't know how much power that was. That wouldn't exactly call that hyper power. That would be like instead of like one of those windmills, it'd be like a pinwheel that like a kid has powering it. Like it's like plugging a potato into something to power a light bulb. It was not much power.
Well, it was enough to do what I think a lot of people have forgotten at this point. Sweep a 2-game set down in Richmond against both teams and then go home and beat Dayton at a time where they were trending towards running away with the A-10 title at that point. That was really what knocked them straight off the tracks.
Honestly, that's the most A-10 stretch ever, is us beating VCU and Richmond back-to-back. I bet they probably went back to campus. I don't know. Maybe they stayed down in Richmond. I don't know. But they beat VCU Richmond back-to-back on the road and then beat Dayton at home on a Saturday night A-10 game on ESPN. Not a Friday night one, surprisingly. The rare Friday night ESPN game. Or Saturday night, sorry. Yeah, I don't know how that happened. And that made all of our optimism go through the roof, and then they went
1-7 to close the rest of the year.
1-7. Yep.
All right. So we'll go into how they're going to perform this year in a second. But one other guy I want to ask about on this roster is Dewayne Thompson. He's a freshman who had multiple Power Six options, actually reclassified to come in. And just like with Pride and Adams Woods, like this is a guy, if he's going to go to a mid-major school, doesn't seem like he'd be reclassifying to go there just to sit on the bench as Mark Schmidt's 11th man all season. But yet he's gotten zero conversation. I don't think I've heard anyone talk about him except for your buddy Unfurled on his podcast with two random replacement guests who were never named on that show. I still don't know who those people were.
Neither do I.
Well, there you go.
I've had a very busy summer, so Unfurled and I are going to be linking up more in the fall.
Good. Well, we certainly love that over on this show. We want to hear more of you guys. We always do.
But definitely.
He's not even listed in the T-ranked top 10 projections. Like, who is this guy? Is he going to see the court? And if he does, what can he give the Bonnies?
To answer your question, is he going to see the court? I have no idea with Schmidt. I mean, I know Daryl Banks and Chad Benning are going to see the court, and nothing else would surprise me. I mean, obviously you would expect Charles Pride and Cairo Loop to play a lot, but I don't know with Schmidt. It depends on what happens in practice. I think Dewayne Thompson has a lot of upside. I haven't really seen much of his tape personally, but I do know that he comes from a very important place in Bonaventure lore, Putnam Science Academy, a little oasis, basically Bonaventure East in the northeastern corner of Connecticut, where Oshun Oshunyi and Kyle Lofton came from. But also, more importantly, Barry Evans is also from Putnam Science. So I'm not sure if they actually play together at the same time, but Putnam Science is more than just a Bonaventure feeder. They feed a bunch of players all over the country and at P5 levels. I don't have any list in front of me about who exactly, but they've definitely sent some players. In terms of Dewayne Thompson himself, it sounds like he's, an efficient scorer, shooting almost 50%. In his last season, he was the 10th ranked prospect in New England. And yeah, he had offers from, you said it, Creighton, Seton Hall, Virginia Tech. I mean, Creighton was a couple bounces away from the Final Four, and Virginia Tech and Seton Hall are pretty good too. So clearly he had some great options and he chose Bonaventure and to reclassify. So if it would be one thing for him to declare for Bonaventure and play next season, but since he's speeding up the process by a year, that does tell me he might have gotten some assurance from the coaching staff that he's going to play. I just don't know how he'll contribute specifically because I'm not aware of him. It seems like he would fall into the same role of Farrell and Barry Evans.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm seeing too. A really athletic rebounder, actually bigger than both of those guys. So maybe even could play some small ball five. But as you say,
you're right. He could be a backup to Venning if you want to, like you said, small ball because he's 6'8".
Yeah, it could be in play. But as you were talking, kind of popped in my head, like, we'll have this discussion, and then by October, we'll find out that he's just redshirting and just didn't want to be in high school anymore. And that's right. Why he reclassified. But we'll close it out. We'll close out this Bonnie segment. I'm going to put you on the spot right here, and I'm going to extend the categories here a little bit because I think leaving the middle too wide gives you too easy of an answer. So one of three things will happen for the Bonnies here, either a double bye contender, so they finish top five, just a kind of ho-hum middle of the pack team like last year, again, 6-9, or in the pillow fight. Right now in August, where do you put these guys?
I would put them top five. I don't know if I'm as high on them as some people are putting them number two, right behind Dayton. I'm not sold on that yet. I need to see some of these guys in action still, but I do think they're right there with Dayton, Duquesne, unfortunately, VCU. They're right there with everybody, I think, towards the top. I just don't know. There's too many unknowns for me to still say that this team can definitely win an A-10 title, but they can certainly get a double bye.
All right. And then who is your preseason pick then, if not the Bonnies?
Oh, I don't know. Probably Dayton. But then I'm only saying that so I can give Dayton the kiss of death there. Like, it seems like every year you want to pick Dayton and then they somehow stumble. So I'll just put that out there into the universe that Dayton will win the A-10. And then,
yeah, the Dayton fans are going to hate that even before you extend it on the curse part. But final Bonaventure question for you here. I talked about during the mailbag, you have this like stretch of death coming at the beginning of December at SUNY Amherst / Buffalo. At Niagara, home for Siena. We know Bonaventure's losing one of those three games.
Oh, God.
Which one would be the most painful of the three?
Niagara. Because, I mean, Siena and you, or SUNY Amherst, almost caught myself there. Siena and SUNY Amherst at least have, like, decent names. Although I think Niagara might actually be the best of these three. Niagara's gym, and I use the word gym specifically. It's... I hate using the term high school gym because I feel like that's a insult everybody throws around. Compared to the A-10, this one is absolutely a high school gym. It's barely 2,000. I saw Charlon Clouf hit a crazy running layup to beat them at the buzzer back in 2013. It's a tin can. It really is. The same thing with Canisius' arena, and I don't know why we still play there every single year. These games should be where the Sabres play. That would be the worst of those three losses. But I am overall excited about the high points of our non-conference schedule, mainly Florida Atlantic. That's going to be at the home of basketball, Springfield, Massachusetts. So I will definitely be there. And then also a little preview of the Barclays Center again for us, for A-10s. They'll be playing Oklahoma State. It was just announced on Thursday that they'll be playing Oklahoma State in the Legends Classic. And so that'll be in November 16th. And then the day after that, they'll play either Auburn or Notre Dame.
Yeah. And that November 16th is shaking out to be a great day where we're going to have St. Louis, Dayton, and St. Bonaventure all playing good games to open up tournaments at 2, 4, and 8 respectively. I think if I am
really
seeing that right.
What time's
so everyone
the
will be
game?
Able to watch them.
I didn't see. I think it was
9. Cause I think they're the second half of a doubleheader that starts at 6:30.
The Bonnies game is at 9.
I think so.
Woo. Okay. late Thursday night in BK again for us, right?
Yeah, it'll be some late night in Brooklyn, although that's later than the A-10 puts games there at this point.
Yeah, sure. They just shifted it. They used to have 9 o'clock games.
Yeah, it's earlier now, but for anyone who is just sticking around for the basketball, Lil Bonna X, where can everybody find you?
Oh, at Lil Bonna X on Twitter and Blue Sky as well. Threads, I guess, but no one's still using that, right? You're not using that.
We were never on there. We wanted to see if it actually took hold.
I had to lock it down. I was so close to locking down the big game boomer, that handle, but I did not, unfortunately. Yeah, thread. I mean, I guess if you want to, I'm not going to see it on Threads. But yeah, Twitter and Blue Sky are the places, not X. We're not talking about X. I am the only X there, Lil Bon X, right?
That is true. Everyone go follow X on Twitter, on Blue Sky, for some great stuff. The real big game boomer. And for anyone who's here to just listen to basketball, probably time to shut this thing off. But for anyone who is here to hear about the Netflix phenomenon, season 3 of I Think You Should Leave.
There we go.
Let's roll into that right now. And we'll just start off real simple. What were your takes on the season?
I was slightly disappointed. I love I Think You Should Leave. And don't get me wrong, it's still incredible comedy. But the thing with the show is that they take huge swings on very awkward situations. And sometimes they are obviously going to miss. It's like, I mean, Tim Robinson is basically part of the post Weekend Update SNL. Like, you know, after Weekend Update on SNL, it's usually the really weird sketches. And sometimes they're incredible. Like, I think Jizz in My Pants was post that, like when it first aired on TV. But then, like, you get some very real, really weird ones. So that I do think that there was a little more filler, a little less funny ones than before. But I will say the funny ones are incredible.
I tend to pretty much agree. And I call that segment after Weekend Update the time for the people who are high.
Yeah.
Because in order to enjoy all of the sketches at that point, you have to be pretty messed up. And that show, like, this season kind of reminds me of a bad version of that at the end, where episodes 5 and 6 might have been the two weakest episodes of the series so far. Like, it was a rough close, and I went back and looked last night, and it's like Don Bon Darley and the one where the guy's just trying to get everyone to watch his weird videos. And so it kind of leaves a more sour taste in your mouth than it should have.
Yeah,
because so much great stuff early on.
I don't really dissect I Think You Should Leave by episodes. I don't think there's much of a real rhyme or reason to why they're put in. I think they do some thematic stuff, but it's not as if we're watching Breaking Bad and it's a serial like drama here. I mean, I think the most iconic moments are obviously going to be 55 burgers, 55 fries, 55 shakes, and then the driving crooner, who, by the way, to make this full circle and go back to the A10, Keith Urgo 100% looks like he should be the driving crooner. I made a picture of it like right after the episodes dropped. I'll send it to you after this. Like, it is perfect. He's the driving crooner.
I tweeted out the morning that it came out, I watched the first episode. And in the very first skit, the one where he's doing like the cable news show.
Yeah.
He looks exactly like Mike Rhodes.
Oh, he always looks like Mike Rhodes. Like I made
really
that joke a few times.
It really gets emphasized in that skit, though. Like, it's perfect.
I don't know what it is about Tim Robinson, because he has a very, very versatile look, because people were also making the same jokes about, there was a great tweet after the U.S. women lost in the World Cup. Somebody said that Vlatko Andalovsky looks like Tim Robinson doing a sketch about Ted Lasso, like a Ted Lasso spoof, but as like a coach who doesn't know anything about soccer. So, like, yeah, Mike Rhodes kind of has that same look too.
Maybe he just should be a coach. But I came up with a few awards for this season, so we'll rip through those rapid fire. So the first one, the hot dog suit award for the meme that is going to extend past the show and to the part of Twitter/X where all the people who've never actually seen it reside and just get very confused.
By the way, I will say the hot dog sketch, when I first saw it, that is the funniest piece of comedy I've ever seen in my life. I mean, I still watch it, and yeah, it's funny. But when I first saw it, it was the funniest piece of comedy I've ever seen in my life, like in a sketch show or anything like that. Like, that was incredible. To answer your question, I think it might be 55 burgers, 55 fries, 55 shakes. Although I think some people that are lazy and have never seen the show will probably, I've seen people who have probably never seen the show use the gif of him texting when he's hosting the cable show, and he's just like, if I don't like what you're saying, I'm gonna go on my phone. And he starts going on his phone. Yeah, I feel like that might be the biggest meme, but I think the biggest joke that is more than just like a gif would be 55 burgers, 55 fries.
I thought the same thing. This was probably the one we were going to agree on. It's going to be that. It's the YouTube short that just constantly pops up into my feed on there. So,
yeah. Well, I wish they didn't show it in the trailer too, but when he honks the horn and just like, when he's getting confronted, he's just like, hey, come on. Unfortunately, they show that.
The lady.
Yeah, when the guy's yelling at him. Like, I wish they didn't show that in the trailer because it kind of like ruined it for me a little bit, but it was still funny.
Yeah, that's why it's tough to watch trailers sometimes. But
yeah,
all right, we'll go to the Dan Flash's sketch for, and there's a lot of this in this show where the sketch that you watched the first time and thought, this is fine, it's kind of funny, but it just never leaves your head. And once you watch it like a second, third time, you realize, oh, this is great.
Yeah. So what would that one be?
For this season, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that would probably have to be Jellybean when he's like the mute. He's basically the mute one-man show. And so he's like, you can't make me laugh or make talk. Otherwise, I have to pay you money. So I think that was the one that kind of grew on me.
I'm so mad about that answer because that's mine too.
Really?
It's the physical comedy piece of it. Because like the sketch itself, the premise is really just not that funny, but it's what Robinson's best at, where it's just him being angry and just kind of throwing his body around every time he speaks and playing around with the hat. Like that's what makes it so golden.
Yeah, he does some things very well. Fast food, weird like fedora-ish hats, and like for some reason cigars. Right, who took my cigars? Yeah. That was season one, I think, right?
God, I forgot about that one too.
Yeah.
But someone needs to put together a meme of the picture of all the frat guys screaming at him and just who everyone is on A10 Twitter in that scene.
I'm gonna get on that today.
Like who is the frat guy with the long like hillbilly hair with the cutoff tank top?
Oh, like in that picture? Oh, I know.
Yeah, and there's multiple different times you could do that in that scene, but yeah. Man, I'm disappointed we agreed on that though. So all right, we'll go to the the Coffin Flop Award for the sketch that you basically can only do on this show, nowhere else, and it's what makes this show great.
Let's see. I'm just quickly scrolling through a list just because, like, I can't remember all this off the top of my head. Like, man, so I think it was probably the metal guy, like, climbing on the wall. Because it was basically, like, the new version of the Chunky skit. But instead of Chunky, like, messing things up, it's this, like, old guy in a metal suit that they were like, oh, he's going to be, like, Speed Racer. Like, going all the way through the board. And he, you know, he's got, like, heavy duty magnets on and can't move.
God, that one I did kind of forget about. It is the best of the last few sketches. I took the Jellytall one because
I didn't like that one.
Just the pure anger and right episode, wrong sketch, because I watched this one last night. That was going to be my answer. It's the one where Beck Bennett has 100 friends.
Yes,
and
that was another.
Kind of end it with the fart just wafting there, and it's just kind of a thought of like this is just nowhere else on television.
Yes, that is true. That one's a really good answer.
He's yelling at him for eating for eating the burger because he's more annoying when he's heavy.
Yeah, you get 200 friends for like a certain price.
He starts accosting the skinny redheaded dude.
Yeah, but for some reason Beck Bennett of all people was doing that.
Yeah, but that just happens. Like, this is throughout the show, Will Forte's ponytail is just randomly stuck in that lady's SUV, and it's kind of the point of the show though.
Okay, I'll give you one. What's, I don't know what to call this one, but what's kind of like the one that took forever? Like, what's, I don't know what you would call the award, but like something that took forever. Cause I feel like that one just took too long for me.
The Armisen sketch is just flat out bad.
Yeah. That was like half the sketch.
I guess kind of the other one is the Patty Harrison at the at the guy's birthday party in the office.
Yeah.
Where it's kind of funny that she's attacking the cutout, but for like 3 minutes, just nothing's happening until they start talking about her rats.
Yeah, it's disappointing because Patty Harrison is hilarious. She was in, she was the one
Not
that was like Santa.
Enough.
Yeah, she was the one. She's like Santa came early in the first season. The second season, she was the one with the tables.
Yeah, that's
the
her
woman
best
in the
moment.
The driving video, and she's the one who's like, I can't stop drinking wine, and she got like a big like lost. She has like a big. She's basically on a Shark Tank parody and got a bunch of money because she got sewn into the Charlie Brown pants of the float at Thanksgiving at the Macy's parade.
You can't stand bald boys.
Oh my god. All right. And popcorn. But yeah, that was an all right sketch. The one I didn't really like, there was like this random woman who was in like the conflict resolution thing. That was another weird one.
Oh yeah. The one where you're not supposed to tell him that he's interesting was that one kind of just got too weird.
Yeah. I like the one where they were in to kind of wrap up. I think you should leave because I think I should leave. It was the one where they were, I don't know if it was diversity training or something, but then like he was making the joke. He was like staring down the guy across the boardroom because they thought they were like pretending to be enemies, but then he took it too far. And then this third guy out of nowhere is just like, everything's gone to shit. Like he just gets angry. He
dumps the water on his head.
Yeah, out of nowhere. Like this third guy, not involved in the sketch at all.
All right. I do want to wrap it up here.
Yeah.
The final award, the Baby of the Year award. What did you think was the best sketch of this season?
Oh, ooh, it might. It's either 55 Burgers or Driving Crooner. I'm going to say Driving Crooner because I did not see that one going that way. Because that one, I was getting worried about at the beginning. I'm like, okay, he's going to drive home his coworkers so they don't get a DUI. That's nice. Okay, where's this going? And then when I saw the hat, I'm like, it was almost like the hot dog moment. Like it was like, oh, this is going somewhere like incredible.
To me, it's Pacific Proposal Park.
That
just
one was
the
good.
Wrestlers just beating up people in this like beautiful soft ground, and the guy with the toilet seat just beating a dude over the head with it is just, it's magic. It's television magic. And if we went for another 20 minutes, I could just go on and on about how the worst part of the season was honestly that Sam Richardson wasn't in it enough. He is the most underrated guy in comedic acting right now, but he just kind of delivers that moment perfectly. So,
well, I think he's taken off from Baby of the Year. I mean, he was in Veep, but he had like a small role in Veep. He wasn't like that big of a player in Veep, but I think he's starting to take off now because he was in the second season of Ted Lasso. He's in some really like really big Apple show. I don't remember the name of it. He's in some good Apple show apparently. So he's really taken off, which is good for him. So he probably just didn't have enough time to mess around with Tim Robinson.
Yeah, but we'll close this thing out here. Sam Richardson, Nick Kroll, let's get them in a buddy comedy together, just doing something wild and chaotic. Little Bonnie
X,
great. Thank you for joining me to talk Bonnies, to talk our first foray into everyone's true favorite television show on A10 Twitter. I think everyone would rather watch this than actual A10 games. But
yeah,
you were the only guy here to break it down with me. You tweeting about it, honestly, was one of the big reasons why I started watching the show a few years ago. So,
yeah, it was great. I mean, it came right before. It was like one of the last funny things before the pandemic began. It was right around that time.
Yeah, a great show and a great guest. Everyone go follow Lil Bonna X. Thank you for joining me.
And be sure to also follow SB Unfurled, too.
Unfurled. Yes.
Yeah, because Unfurled and I haven't had our podcast since basically the end of last season. We're going to try to get things going again in the fall. Like I said, been busy in the summer, so he and I haven't been able to get together, but it's okay because, I mean, with the transfer portal, there's not really much you can talk about in June. You don't know when half the teams are. So be sure to follow at SB Unfurled on Twitter to also get tons of Bonnie's coverage, more serious stuff than me, and also we'll be having more of our podcasts as the season gets closer.
Yeah, a top 3 A10 podcast, so everyone be sure to go listen to that. All right, another thanks to everyone who sent in those great mailbag questions, and a thanks to Lil Bonna X for joining me today. Talk Bonnies, and I think you should leave. We'll be back likely one more time here in August and then two or three times in September. October team previews right around the corner, not too far away, so just keep an eye out for any of those episodes between now and then. And be sure to go back. We got plenty of episodes throughout the summer that have all aged well, all still worth a listen. Petey Buckets on the George Mason early off season. Go back, take a listen to that. Also got Hoops Weiss talking about the Big Five. Hawk Hill Hardwood about St. Joe's specifically. We did our red, white, and blue chips for next year, kind of diving into some of the specific players. And then Kevin Sweeney talking about Loyola. All great episodes, all worth your time if you have not yet listened to those. So be sure to go back and do so. And be sure to tune in here in a few weeks, as I said, likely one more episode coming in August. That'll be coming your way soon.